Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Chuck Thacker, legendary computing pioneer, 2009 ACM Turing Award recipient, 2007 IEEE John von Neumann Medal recipient, distinguished, celebrated, preeminent, world-renowned researcher and engineer. Chuck will be receiving this highest computing honor, the ACM Turing Award, in a special ceremony in June 2010. Chuck, you have a lifetime of outstanding contributions in a number of fields. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
You're quite welcome.
Chuck, when did you hear about this extraordinary honor, you know, this recipient of this widely considered Nobel Prize in Computing, the 2009 ACM Turing Award? And as a follow-up, how did you feel at the time and the reaction of your colleagues and family?
Well, I heard about it in mid-February when Alan Kay called me on the phone and told me about it. And I was completely shocked because I never expected to get this award. If you look at the ACM Turing Award, the last time, despite the name of the organization, the last time it was awarded to an individual whose primary area of expertise was actually building and designing computing machinery was in 1967. So it's been a long time between such people, and I figured I'd never get it. Because normally it's awarded people who are either software people or theorists. So it was a complete shock. And how did I feel? Well, I was honored, of course, but quite surprised. And the general reaction was, I think, among my colleagues, was equivalent surprise, because most of the other people who were in that area at the time that the subject of the award work was done have either received the award long ago or received other similar awards. So that I think, is sums it up quite nicely. It's a great honor, of course.
And the reaction from your family?
My wife was shocked, because I've told her all along, you know, this is highly improbable. There were some awards that I think were within the realm of possibility, but the Turing Award was not one of them. So when I told her that evening, well, of course, it's happy. But yes, it was one of great surprise.
And you said you got the announcement from Alan Kay. So you worked with Alan Kay at PARC, didn't you?
That's right.
And he's a prior Turing Award winner as well, I believe.
Correct.
So when you look back, what special qualities make you excel at innovating new technologies?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that come to mind. First of all, I worked very hard on my education at an early age. I mean, I knew, for instance, when I was 6 years old that I was an engineer. I thought that I would be doing something quite different than what I wound up doing, but I've prepared myself for my career for a long time. Another thing is that I try to read as widely as possible and be aware of what technologies are becoming plausible as things that can be used in the construction of new things, new other things. I've always been privileged, I would say, to have excellent colleagues, and that's very important. Particularly in an industrial setting, you lack something that people in academia have, which is graduate students to help you with research. So if you want to do similar things in an industrial setting, you have to convince your colleagues that the projects are good enough to have them devote effort to it too. So I think that pretty much sums that up.
I see. So your father was an engineer as well.
That's correct.
And you had an early start, I guess, or an opportunity working in some kind of inventor's workshop. Could you describe that process?
Yes. When I was going to school, student loans were not a concept. So I was planning to take a year off between graduating from Berkeley in physics and going to graduate school somewhere in physics. And I was working with a fellow with whom I had worked before. I was basically self-supporting all the way to school. And he had started an inventorship in Berkeley. And I made him a deal. I said, if you will teach me to operate your machine tools, I will design electronics for you, because that was, you know, mechanical things were his strength and mine were electronic things. And that worked out very well. We built some pretty interesting gadgets, and it actually led to my taking a job at the Genie Project at the University of California, which led to everything else.
Can you describe the types of technologies being created or updated that will drive the user computer experience in 10 years? And then as a follow-up, what will this experience be like if you can paint a picture for an audience? And then what ways in the next 5 years does this intersect and extend your work with a groundbreaking tablet PC?
Well, the type of technologies, I think, are information access technologies. I mean, we have seen an awful lot of progress in that area. The web and the internet have made it, you know, have made us approximately able to do what Vannevar Bush wanted in his Mimex device at the end of World War II. But organization and assistance from the computer in carrying out the tasks that I want to do, we're still quite lacking there. I have quite a bit of difficulty accessing certain kinds of information, and the computer could help me quite a bit in organizing things, if you will. I mean, I think back in the early days of the web, it's like the largest library in the world, except that all the books are together in the middle of the floor. And by and large, it's still that way. Search engines have helped, but there's still a long way to go.
So if you were to forecast what the experience would be like in the future, what do you think that will be like?
Well, one of the things that I would like to see happen is, you know, things like the tablet PC were very nice. And, of course, the GUI that we all use today that grew out of the Alto, there's still definitely a place for that. But there's also a place for having a more natural interaction with the computer. I would like to carry out a dialogue with my computer to explain what I'm trying to do and have it help me do that. And I can't do that yet.
I see. It kind of reminds me of the Natal project out of Microsoft Research, which is going to be released later this year.
Yes.
But it looks like this sort of ability to do an interactive dialogue, you have sensors, so you don't have to directly manipulate devices. And I think your wife has even indicated that she doesn't like this sort of experience where, you know, the computers are obvious, right?
Well, she's always argued for invisible computers. Those are the ones she likes best, computers that do things for you that you're not even aware of. For instance, computers in your car, embedded system. Of course, they're still not very good in the sense that I still have dings in my car because I was driving it rather than having the computer drive it.
You know, it's interesting. You're one of the initial members of the team that founded Xerox PARC, and Bob Taylor was there, and he actually laid out a vision for computing. Can you describe that vision and how that inspired you?
Well, I think there were two components of that. Taylor was very interested. I mean, you have to remember that Taylor was not a technologist, a psychologist. So he was more interested in the human uses of computers, and in particular, using the computer as a communication device. That was one thread of that. And the other one is man-computer symbiosis. And a lot of people have worked on the latter. I think the former we've got pretty much solved. People communicate all the time. In fact, they communicate incessantly, I would say, if you look at things like Twitter. But as far as symbiosis between humans and computers, that we don't know how to do.
You know, there's some early research on neural or brain mind interfaces. You know, there's the Natal project where you have sensors who can pick up body movements, and there's voice recognition. Maybe in the next 3 to 5 years, you see some kind of more natural interface?
I hope. I mean, these things tend to take much longer than you originally think they will. We've had several waves of artificial intelligence research, for instance, and artificial intelligence now applied, it basically means something that doesn't work. When it starts working, for instance, things like machine learning, you give it another name.
And I guess that sort of speaks back to, you know, with the Alto, where there was, probably a 12-year lag between all the innovation that was done with that and then where you kind of see it more commonplace in Macs and PCs and so on.
Well, there was good reason for that. If you look at the Alto was an example of this business about technology just being possible, making it just barely possible to build something that was economical and could be applied to needs of a single user. It took another decade for progress in microelectronics to make it much more affordable. And that was just technological progress. It was quite predictable, actually.
And I guess that relates back to Moore's Law as well.
That's right. And Moore's Law was something that we understood at PARC pretty well. We actually made use of the first integrated circuit random access memory in the Mac system we built just before the Alto. So we got that, but it took a long time. I mean, if you think about the Alto is actually the user experience of the Alto, definitely the predecessor of the user experience on today's PCs. But the hardware is not. The hardware is actually the predecessor of what was called in the 80s scientific workstation. Much higher performance than PCs, but much more limited in their scope.
I guess with the Alto, there's all of this sort of localization of storage and memory and processing power, sort of multi-threading, you know, that even that aspect. You're using RAM to bitmap your display. It's a lot of innovation.
Well, that was purely a matter of cost. The cost of RAM had just become low enough, less than 1/10 of a cent bit, that you could envision putting a bit of memory behind every pixel on display. That was a new thing that just simply couldn't have been done until the technology was ready.
Why the name Alto?
Palo Alto.
Oh, yes, of course.
It's easy.
Right. How would you describe your three top innovative achievements in terms of what specifically inspired those innovations, and then what were the factors that made the innovations possible, the problems you're trying to solve, your solutions, and the impact it has today and into the longer-term future?
Well, of course, the most important one was probably the Alto itself and a lot of the technology that surrounded it. The thing that was interesting about the Alto was not only that it was that it was a personal machine, but that it was part of a distributed system. And that aspect people sometimes lose. The power of the Alto was that a lot of them were connected together and were connected to things like printers that were not economical for a single person to have. They are today. I mean, I have a printer next to my computer that's approximately as good as the one I had at Park, but the one at Park cost a lot more, and there was only one of them. So what were the inspirations for that? Well, we were part of the Xerox Corporation, and we were interested in helping office workers. I mean, the slogan for a lot of that work was the paperless office. Of course, if we'd realized how laser printer printing was going to take over, we would have used some other slogan. And another major, what can I say, inspiration for the Alto came not from Bob Taylor, but from Doug Engelbart. Doug gave this wonderful demo in 1968, I believe, in which he demonstrated for the first time the basically a user interface similar, very similar to the one that we actually ultimately built and evolved. I mean, he had mice. He did not have bitmap displays exactly, but a lot of the ideas were there. And what he was trying to do was the man-computer symbiosis aspect with his online system. Okay, so you wanted a couple more. I'm particularly proud of some of the networking that we did at the DEX Systems Research Center in the mid-80s and early 90s, because those networks, one of them actually became a DEC product, and perhaps more importantly, many of the techniques that were developed in those networks are now coming into much wider use today as networks proliferate and get faster. Things like guaranteed quality of service. That's something that the Internet right now can't provide, but the Internet Engineering Task Force is beginning to look at solutions that are similar to the things that we developed back then to mitigate these problems. So that's pretty gratifying. And I would say a third thing, I mean, there are a lot of things that I could be proud of, some of which have been economic successes and some of which have not. But one of the things that I'm actually quite proud of is very recent work on the B3, which is this FPGA platform for enabling new kinds of computer science architecture research. And the nice thing about that is that it is a common platform that people at disparate universities can use, and they can share results, which is not done much to date. So this may actually change to some extent the way people do architecture work, which I think would be quite good, because that's the way the field evolves.
I guess you've talked about how, you know, all of our concepts of computing were developed 20, 30, 40 years ago, and it's kind of an old paradigm, and now everything's changed. The technology has changed. The economics have changed. And so we have to kind of play out of that sandbox, right, and look a little bit more broadly. And I think your work with the field programmable gate arrays and so on, I guess that kind of ties into that.
Actually, it's interesting. I'm becoming more interested recently in doing exactly the opposite. Technology has changed so much in the last 40, 50 years that it seems to me that it behooves us to look back at some of the ideas that we looked at in the early days and either dismissed or went down other paths and see if they didn't, for instance, have more merit than we thought. And another, the converse of that is that we should look at some of the things that we did adopt and say, are those still good ideas in light of the way technology's moved on? So, yes, I think there's, it's important to continuously innovate new things, but sometimes it's a good idea to look to the past.
I'm just thinking, does that speak to then not so much going and increasing complexity, but also driving to some simplicity as well?
Absolutely. I mean, complexity, in computing, complexity is the enemy. Everything should be done that is possible to minimize the complexity of the systems that we build, because in complexity lurks error. And we are now so dependent as a society on computing that errors are getting less and less acceptable. And the only way that I know of to do that is to reduce the error rate is to minimize complexity. I mean, there are certain theoretical techniques that you can use that go a long way too, but they're still quite difficult for engineers to use.
And that seems to be an underlying principle of your career, right? Driving towards elegance and simplicity.
Absolutely. That's what I've tried to do. I mean, I've tried to put the word elegant in every paper I've ever written.
When I look at that team, you know, that was working at Berkeley originally on that, what I guess the Genie project, and then, you know, you go to the Berkeley computing company, you know, and you create this device, and then you go on to the Xerox PARC, and then some of that team goes on to Digital Equipment, starting the Systems Research Center. It almost reminds me of Fairchild and their Fairchildren. You know, Fairchild creates integrated circuits, and then that spawns a lot of little child industries, and you have some of the same parties moving on again and again and again. I mean, does that follow? Does that kind of make sense that, you know, you got this group and it's this innovative team and they continue on throughout their life? In fact, you're probably still in contact with many of them.
In contact with them. I work with a lot of them daily. I mean, many of the people who started out at Xerox PARC or even for Xerox PARC are now working in the Mountain View lab of Microsoft. So it's not a matter of keeping in contact with them. It's a matter of working with them on a daily basis. That's kind of what I meant when I said it's a good idea to pick your colleagues carefully. And I have been privileged in being able to do that.
Can you share, you know, the names of some of these colleagues?
Well, of course, my primary collaborator throughout my career has been Butler Lampson. He's actually at the Massachusetts Laboratory of Microsoft now, but it's people like Roy Levin and Mike Schroeder and Andrew Burrow and several others. And of course, over the years, that group has expanded. But as I say, many of the people who started at DeckCirc are now at Microsoft.
And I guess if you look at Rick Rashad, who kind of, you know, is the senior VP of Microsoft Research, he was inspired by your work on the Alto and Ethernet and so on.
Rick was actually one of our first users. Rick is a Star Trek fan and was at that time. And he wrote a video game for the Alto. It's called Alto Trek.
So what are your specific drivers and goals for each of the labs that you have started, and what are the notable outcomes or contributions from these labs?
Well, of course, Xerox PARC was the first one, and possibly the most influential and possibly the least commercially successful, at least for the organization that sponsored the labs, Bert Xerox. There we were interested in, as I said, the theme was the paperless office, although what we actually wound up doing was something quite different. That was the paperless office, just a part of it. And one of the nice things about PARC was that we were able to build systems that we could actually use ourselves. I mean, we wanted nice documents because if you publish a lot, you're constantly producing documents. And the procedure for doing so at that time for publication in journals was really dreadful, involving typewriters and rubber cement and camera-ready copy boards, things like that. And that was all swept away by the technology. At DeckCirc, I think we were actually much more aware of the need to make computers more accessible. And we had seen, and we were actually somewhat more commercially oriented because we really wanted DEC to see. For the first time, we were actually in a computer company, not a copier company. And so we could much more directly have impact on what the company did. So that was important. At Microsoft, I think it's the same thing, although primary mission of Microsoft Research is to advance the field, we're also quite interested in making sure that Microsoft be around for quite a long time. So I think those themes keep cropping up throughout what I've done.
And I guess you helped in the founding of their Cambridge laboratory.
That's right. That was my first job was actually to move there, take a 2-year assignment, and help Roger Needham, who was a good friend, and the director of the lab get it started. And I think that's worked out quite well. The lab is quite successful.
It's kind of an interesting story because you were proposing to set up a lab in Silicon Valley, and he was proposing one in the UK, and he won out. Maybe you can share some of the insides of that story.
Well, it actually made a certain amount of sense. It would be much more efficient to keep all research centralized, and having a lab in the same time zone as the Redmond lab was not something that they really wanted to consider at that time. But on the other hand, it was pretty clear that there are a lot of Europeans who don't want to raise their children as tiny Americans. And if Microsoft was going to grow in the areas in which it did business, which is now global, we would have to locate labs there. So we started the Cambridge lab, and when that worked out fairly well, we started a lab in Beijing. And when that worked out well, we started a lab in Bangalore. And then finally, we decided to start the lab in Cambridge, I mean in Silicon Valley. And then most recently, we have a lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So we've got both Cambridges covered.
I guess kind of sort of the word Cambridge, there's that interesting story about when you indicated you had an offer to go to Cambridge and your wife thought it was Boston, right?
Right. And she said no very emphatically until I said, no, love, the other one.
Did you interface that much with Soma Somasegar?
Not very much, no.
So there's a lot of independence then between Microsoft Research and the other parts of Microsoft.
There is a lot of independence, but there's also a lot of interaction. I mean, we work very closely with product groups in a variety of areas. So it's definitely not an ivory tower kind of organization. We're in the trenches with them.
Okay, let's sort of move up to the current times then. What are the major goals of your current research? And then what are the challenges? What are the opportunities, implications? And then as a follow-up, what are the three major research threads, opportunities, and challenges and working with the new parallel programming models for massively multi-core processors?
Well, I think that sums it up quite well. Right now, we're at an inflection point as an industry. Computers are not going to get a lot faster unless there's some major technological breakthrough that we don't understand yet. Quantum computing might be that, but I was just talking to a fellow who's also at Microsoft, but in our quantum computing group in Santa Barbara, and he says, yes, it's a constant 10 years away. So people are working on it, but we don't see it. So what's going to happen over the next few years is we're not going to see faster computers, that is, computers that can run a program or a single-threaded program more quickly. We're going to see more. And right now, we're hard-pressed to program those things. And some of that is just programming, and some of it is the way the computers themselves are organized. And that's the area in which I'm working right now. That was the purpose of the B3. My most recent project is the Beehive environment for exploring mini-core architecture through FPGAs. So I think that the primary challenge for the next few years in computing is going to be mastering parallelism and applying it to the kinds of problems that today don't admit very much of very much parallelism.
So I guess that sort of goes to this next question then, and what are the stages in the future evolution of field programmable gate arrays, the Berkeley Emulation Engine version 3 or B3 that you talked about earlier, Beehive, which you just mentioned, transactional memory, and Barrelfish?
Well, those things are all different. I mean, the B3 is a platform for doing research. It's actually fairly expensive, so looked to much simpler hardware platform for the Beehive so that it would be more accessible to a larger number of people. Since we are not a hardware company, we can share these kinds of designs very freely for research purposes with the world, and we do in fact do that. So the Beehive was actually done in response to the observation that I had made that people doing research in mini-core computing don't actually have mini-core systems to work with except in simulation. And so what I was trying to do there was build a system that was simple enough that it could be easily understood by students and their professors and so on, and yet which was malleable enough that you could change it, carry out experiments, not so much at the instruction set level, but at the level of, for instance, how the cores communicate with their memories and how they exchange information among themselves and those kinds of things. Now, Barrelfish is actually an operating system that was developed as a joint effort between our people at our Cambridge lab and ETH Zurich, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. And Barrelfish is interesting because it does one of those things that I mentioned of looking backwards. Barrelfish relies very heavily for its inter-process communication on message paths, not on transferring information shared memory. And this hasn't actually been done for a long time. So we're using Barrelfish to try to figure out whether that is a better way to organize mini-core computers, more along the lines of a distributed system rather than something that has a lot of computers sharing a common memory.
When do you anticipate publishing your next paper?
Fairly soon. I'm not actually in the business of publishing a lot externally anymore. I don't believe that publishing incremental papers is a good idea. I would prefer to, you know, publish fewer papers but have them be very influential.
Do you collaborate that much with Doug Terry, who's working on the distributing computing side?
Doug Terry is right down the hall from me. So the answer is a bit, but not enormously. His interests are in a different area, different but related.
You know, for the audience who aren't familiar with the Berkeley Emulation Engine, can you kind of sort of give it a hardware view of what it is?
Sure. It's a large printed circuit board that has on it four fairly large field programmable gate arrays and a large amount of input-output. It's not a computer in itself. The way a field programmable gate array works is you do a design in a hardware description language called Verilog, and you run that through a compiler, and that produces the logic that you want to build. And that is actually turned by tools supplied by Xilinx Corporation to a bitstream, which is loaded into the FGA, which then looks like what your design is. So you can think of it as exactly what it's called. Programmable in the field, you can change what it does dynamically, and it essentially supplies a large number of logic gates that you can use to implement anything that you describe as a Verilog program. Until relatively recently, these things were not suitable for the kind of things that we're using them for today because they didn't provide enough logic, but now they do, and so it opens up new possibilities. And I'm sure that what will happen is field programmable gate arrays are on a Moore's law curve just like everything else, and they will get larger and they will get a bit faster, but not a whole lot. And that will make them more and more applicable for the kinds of research that we do.
And as an extension now, can you talk about Beehive again, giving sort of a Harvard view?
Well, Beehive is a specific example of a design that was done in order to map it into a field programmable gate array. Consists of a relatively simple CPU core, and there are many of them on the board that we typically run it on. You put 13 cores and a memory controller and a display controller and an Ethernet controller. That's a complete computer, except that it's a 13-process computer. Each of the processors is not nearly as fast as the computer on your desk, but there are a lot of them. So you can experiment with changes to the architecture, make those changes much more rapidly than you can if you're actually having to build real chips, and run experiments with it at speeds that cannot be achieved by software simulators.
And they've been pretty widely distributed.
Not yet. We have distributed some of the things that we have developed for FPGA users, but we're just beginning now to distribute the Beehive. We have used it in a short class at MIT in January, and it's being used at ETH Zurich, where the Barrelfish work is done. We plan to release it more widely as requested, I think, is the best way to put it.
But the cost is pretty low.
Well, the board itself is available to academics for $750. So
here's a sort of a broader question. Can you describe the intersection of machine learning, the semantic web, and collaborative filtering?
Well, they're all, to some extent, examples of the thing. As I think I said earlier, machine learning is what you call artificial intelligence work. It's really about deriving meaning from large data sets. Of course, collaborative filtering is a similar thing. The basic idea there is if I like A and someone else likes A and B, then I'm kind of likely to like B. So this is the way, for instance, that Amazon produces recommendations for you. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But those are pretty well defined techniques. What was the other item that you learned?
And then the semantic web.
Oh, well, I'm not quite sure what the semantic web is, actually. I've heard that used for a lot of different things over the last 10 or 15 years. And basically, it's an attempt to basically give meaning to what you find in a large web of information. But I'm not sure that has worked out as well as the other two things you asked about.
You're saying that machine learning and collaborative filtering has undergone major evolution, but the semantic web, the promise is not yet fulfilled, perhaps.
That's correct.
What are your views on quantum computing? Because you talked about this a little bit earlier.
Well, I would like to see it happen in some ways, although primary uses of it are to do things that are pretty scary, like make it much more easy to get around encryption, which I think is one component of privacy. We would not want to see broken. So far, the progress in quantum computing has been very, very slow. It's a little like fusion. You know, fusion is a constant 10 years off, and quantum computing should be the same way. But you know, something could happen. Never underestimate physics.
You know, you talked about this earlier, you know, people who you've worked with, and I'm sure there are mentors within that group as well. And so past, present, and future, can you name three or more who inspire you and why this is so?
Well, as I say, I think I've been constantly inspired by all my colleagues and collaborators. Externally, I would say Doug Engelbart as an example. That demo had a very profound effect on me. Within computing, probably people like Ivan Sutherland, who did a lot of early innovation, and actually another less well-known person, Wesley Clark, who built in the early 60s a machine that very interesting called the LINC, the laboratory instrument. And that was the same kind of thing that I'm doing today. It was an attempt. It was a computer to support biomedical research. And it was built, actually, at a summer workshop. If you wanted one of these computers, you went to Washington University of St. Louis, and you built it as part of this summer workshop and took it back to your medical research place.
I guess a natural follow-up then would be, you know, those are people who have inspired you who are in the technical or scientific fields, but maybe outside of computing?
A guy that actually I have been quite impressed by over the years is Bunnell, who was arguably the greatest 19th century British engineer. And he did a lot of things that were really quite innovative in the use of materials, building bridges. He built by far and away the largest ship that had been built to date, the Great Eastern. He did a lot of great things. And this was at a time when engineering was very much less of a science than it is today.
Chuck, you know, you continue to make significant historical contributions. How will your growing status contribute to your vision for the world, society, industry, academia, and technology?
That's a sort of a wide open question. And I think you have to realize that people like me who are fundamentally researchers are working below the radar to improve the world. I think most people don't know we exist. Relatively few people actually know what the Turing Award is, as far as society as a whole goes. Sometimes, if you have a good, you know, PR department and so on, it does sneak up above the level of the noise of modern civilization. But by and large, I think we work in our laboratories doing what we do best, and a lot of the benefits just never become part of civilization, but people don't really understand where they came from. I mean, I think relatively few PC users understand the history of personal computing at all. And there are relatively few organizations that are working to preserve that. Computer History Museum here in the Bay Area is one of the notable ones, but there are very few.
Chuck, you laid many of the pillars for modern-day computing as one of the top groundbreaking visionary innovators. You know, distilling from your very long experience, what are the greater burning challenges and research problems for today's youth to solve to inspire them to go into computing?
Well, this is a difficult question because I've actually taken a crack several times, taken a run at the question about how we can use computing to further education, because I'm quite worried that our kids are not going into science and engineering at a rate that they used to. And when I was going to school, we had Sputnik, and that was a tremendous motivator for people to enter engineering and science, even though those subjects are quite difficult. We don't really have that today, and I suspect that is a large part of the reason that more kids don't do it. What motivates kids? Well, kids like to build things. So one of the things that I'm quite positive about is robotics, because it used to be 25 years ago that kids wanted to learn how to program, and they did, and then they could, you know, drive turtles around on the screen and that and the other thing. And some of them became interested in computing as a result, but by and large, I think that effort was a flop. Robotics is perhaps a bit different. There, the kid can actually create something tangible and physical. And so when I was a kid, we had Heath kits, electronic kits that you could buy from the company and assemble them, and then they would do nice things. Like, I was a ham radio operator, and I built my radio station from a Heath kit. Robotics, in my view, is the 21st century Heath kit. And I think it offers a lot of opportunity.
Are you able to expand on your work in this area to maybe provide some available tools or more tools for the youth to work with robotics?
Well, I certainly have no direct connection with that right now. It might happen in the future. And we do work on robotics in Microsoft. Some of the stuff that I'm doing might become applicable in that area. We just don't know. We have to wait and see how it plays out.
Do you have any additional sort of maybe challenges that you think the youth can get involved with just to get them inspired?
Well, as I say, what we need is something like Sputnik. We need a sense of urgency, and I don't think we have that right now. But things are a lot different today. I mean, one of the things that I really tried to do a few years ago was figure out how we could use a computer to more effectively teach kids to read, because reading is the basic skill. And quite frankly, I was unsuccessful, even though we consulted with a lot of people in education schools who know how learning works. We tried to build both devices and programs to help kids learn to read, but it didn't work out very well. Not everything does.
I'm thinking that it somewhat ties in with your work with the tablet too, right? Making a platform that's easily accessible. Maybe the iPad is just another version of your tablet, just, you know, gone to the next stage. But really it's based on your foundational work and the proliferation of smartphones. Maybe that'll become the platform.
Well, I haven't actually seen the iPad yet, so I don't have an opinion about it. Phones, as I think I've mentioned earlier, I'm quite optimistic of the phone as a platform.
I know that I had a discussion with another chief scientist, and he was indicating that there's more cell phones or mobile phones than there are actually people with shoes.
That is probably true.
Okay, now, if you can choose the topic area, what do you see as the three top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Well, the latter part of the question is more difficult, because if I knew how to solve them, I would. But the three top challenges, you mean in computing, of course.
Or outside of computing.
Outside of computing. Well, if you want me to range more freely, of course, we have to begin doing a better job of taking care of the planet. And I think technology has a lot to say about that and a lot to do. And computing is going to be a part of that, a big part. Within computing, I think we tend to, particularly at times like this, look at the great things that we have done. But we should also be looking at the great things that we haven't done. I mean, as I said, I don't like the fact that I have to drive my car. That seems to be nuts. The computer can do a much better job. Why not let it? My friend Butler actually had a slogan for that. He wants to see reckless driving, where reckless has a W. Third challenge. But getting computers to really help people carrying out their daily tasks. I mean, I still drive the computer. The computer is not my assistant. You know, I can't delegate a task to it and have it do it. So I think those are the three big ones.
And I guess that speaks to what your wife said earlier about, you know, the computers that I like are invisible computers,
mm-hmm.
and that I don't have to interact with them, like, for example, in a car, right? So,
right.
And then she commented, the way I see you interacting with computers is dumb.
Right. Well, you have to understand that she doesn't use computers. I'm her secretary. I exchange her email with her friends and do anything that she needs done.
Well, that's because she wants that seamless integration that you talk about that has to happen at some point, right?
Exactly. I'm sure that's it. She wants me to do what she wants to do, which is a reasonable aspiration.
So over your long and distinguished career, and it's a really remarkable career, what are your top three lessons that you want to share with the broad audience?
Top three lessons. Well, I think choose your colleagues carefully, because to the extent that they help you, you will be more successful. And to the extent that you can help them, they will be successful. Of course, valuing simplicity and elegance, I think that's the most important aspect of engineering, not mastering complexity, but eliminating. Third lesson, pick your problems carefully. You don't want to pick problems that you can't solve, where there's some fundamental barrier to doing it. That's one reason that I have never been very interested in artificial intelligence, because I had no lever. So that's three, probably the top one.
And I guess this speaks to your career where, you know, when you say choosing your colleagues carefully, the same colleagues that you were at somewhat at Berkeley, then onto Park, went on to Digital Equipment, and then onto Microsoft as well. And then simplicity and elegance being sort of the key points of all of your work pretty much throughout your entire life. And you being so successful because you being able to work on problems that are solvable.
Well, and some of that is just being in the right place at the right time.
Or a mark of a true genius, and many have commented that you are one of those remarkable geniuses out there. What are the two most significant challenges that you could not overcome at the time, and then what would you do differently now?
Well, I think the biggest problem that we had with the Alpha system and stuff that we developed at Park was the fact that the manager didn't understand the work. How I would change that, I'm not sure. We tried to explain to them. We conducted courses for the Xerox board of directors to try to explain, you know, what computing was all about, why it was important to Xerox's business, and we just failed. We just simply failed. Books had been written about it. But that was one challenge that we were just not able to overcome. And I think I'm frustrated about the business about how to educate kids better. I don't have a good lever there. I haven't done a good job there, I think. And I don't mean just teaching kids programming. This is not really the high point of it for me, teaching kids how to learn. So that's been fairly frustrating.
I'm just thinking on the first aspect of trying to better maybe leverage and utilize the results of the research, but, you know, some of that's going to occur at Microsoft Research.
Microsoft is a very different company. Its managers do understand technology deeply.
And then I guess the other part would be, impassioning youth to enter technology or pursue a career in the sciences and computing. But one of the ways you can do that is by doing this interview, because you're sharing your insights, you're sharing your passion, you're sharing how you did things, how you got involved with projects, you know, what were the results of that, and even winning, you know, computing's highest honor, which is considered a Nobel Prize of Computing, that Turing Award. I mean, it's a significant recognition that people will hear about and kids will hear about it, and it will inspire them to continue.
Well, I hope so.
Well, Chuck, you know, we're at the end of this interview, and I know your schedule is very demanding, so thank you for coming in today, and we are indeed fortunate that you did this interview, and you have so much wisdom to share with our audience, so again, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Chuck Thacker, legendary computing pioneer, 2009 ACM Turing Award recipient, 2007 IEEE John von Neumann Medal recipient, distinguished, celebrated, preeminent, world-renowned researcher and engineer.